All right, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the February DEEB meeting. First item on the agenda is introductions. I'm Seth Halling with AKS Engineering.
Ryan Wilson with Wilson Architects.
Dan Weisner, Songbird Homes.
Mike Odrin, Olson Engineering, a division of McKay Esposito.
Sherry Jones, Southwest Washington Contractors Association.
Megan Fletcher, Community Development.
Michaela, come on, man. Touch that one.
Sorry.
Michaela Rankin, Community Development.
Nicole Pizik, Community Development.
All right, going online, Jackie.
Jackie Lane, just member of the public.
Rod.
Rod Swanson, Clark County Public Works Department.
Jennifer.
Jennifer Reynolds, Development Engineering. Clark County Development Engineering.
Jose Alvarez, Clark County Community Planning.
Brandy.
Brandy McElrath, Quail Homes.
John.
John Gerard, Quail Homes.
Nikki.
Nikki Olson, Clark County Development Inspection.
Jamie.
Jamie Housley, Bird Ramis. Apologize. I'm getting ready for a big court hearing tomorrow. Thank you.
And anyone else online?
That random number up there.
Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
And then also a reminder that this meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEEB website. We want to review and adopt the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I have reviewed them and move for approval without exception.
And second?
I'll second.
All those in favor, signify by aye.
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 Thank you. Moving on to member announcements. Is there any announcements from DEEB members?
Yeah, I do, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Just a quick update on our favorite topic as of late, the shared outdoor recreation space issue. I don't know how many enjoyed the public hearing that took place last month. I'll just give you a few of my thoughts. First of all, I don't look forward to anybody having to deal with cement batch plants anytime soon, because that was an issue. But with regards to the topic at hand, I don't know what more we can do. It was clear that it was apparent that the council already had their minds made up, except one, that they had, I think, rehearsed the process through which to get this section removed from the biannual code amendments, and I would love to be corrected on that. They are going to take this as a separate policy issue. I don't know what more we can do to convince them of what our concerns are. And so I'm going to put this to bed for a while, me personally, because I've spent a lot of time and effort on it to get nowhere. My main concern for the county is that if this doesn't get resolved, that someone comes along in the R43 zoning district, somebody like the Housing Authority, and would like to build out low-income housing to the greatest density possible, and lowest cost of construction possible, say three-story or four-story walk-ups, and they won't be able to do it because the code won't allow for an overlap of landscape areas and landscape portion of shared outdoor recreational space. That could result in legal action being taken because that can't be done. I guess we'll just kind of have to see how that all plays out. And if staff needs Deeb's help in working through this and how to approach it with the council, as well as the Planning Commission, again, we'll just cross that bridge when we get to it. That's all I have to say.
Any other announcements from Deeb members? Okay, we skipped over the upcoming meetings. Megan, typically on the second page, there's typically a list of meetings. It looks like here there may not be any scheduled. So for today, we'll skip that. One of the other items is the upcoming council work session with Deeb. Typically that's in March, and it sounds like the council is the one who sets the date of that, I believe. We need to request it. Okay.
Yeah, so even if you were to reach out to them now and just to get some time scheduled, because the closer it gets to that time, the more their schedules fill up. And we typically like to book it for an hour and a half. We usually can't get through everything in an hour, and it doesn't allow time for like questions or anything like that.
And then alongside that, Jamie and I will be working to prepare the draft list of accomplishments and the work plan for the upcoming year, and then plan to review that with the board here at the March meeting. So that can be on that March agenda.
And Mike, I will be sure to tell how effective you were this year. Just kidding.
Gee, thanks, Jamie. always have my best interest in always have my best interest in mind. Real effective. Got nothing done.
Nothing done. Okay. Appreciate it, man.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Seth, this is Jose Alvarez with Clark with Community Planning. Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
So the Department of Commerce has a public comment period open for draft guidance that they're doing on making adequate provisions to accommodate all housing needs. This just came out last Wednesday that I got the email, but the public comment period runs through February 24th. So I just wanted to make sure that pass the link on to you all and make you aware of that, because that's going to impact how we, the local jurisdictions, account for some of the housing requirements in the upcoming comp plan update. So I just wanted to make sure you are aware of it.
Okay. Yeah, if you could forward that link on and it could be passed to the D members, that'd be great. With that, Terry, would you like to introduce yourself for the record?
Sure. I'm Terry Wallen with Wallen
Position. With that, the next item on the agenda
hey, Seth,
is park impact.
Seth,
go ahead.
Seth, I think Jeff also joined us online. So.
All right.
So Riston's with us?
Yes, he's with us. He got invited to the room.
I am. My video is not working. I apologize, but I tried to fix it and I got cut off, so I'm not going to do that again.
Well, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
With that, Rocky, if you'd like to present the park impact fees.
Thank you. for the record, Rocky Houston, Parks and Lands Division of Public Works here for Clark County. I was asked, before I start, and besides me on my left, your right, is David Stipe. He is my our division's planning and development manager, so a lot of his work will be working with you and community development in developing our capital plan and implementing that capital plan, a lot of planning around the county. So I just wanted to make sure he was here as well and you guys got some eyes on. It's great to have this opportunity again to actually get within 6 feet of each other. I'm glad we have that sign helping us with that. So I was asked to come because I believe there's a few questions potentially for maybe the last time we came, and I'm probably the second or third face since the last time we came. It's been a lot of change through the last couple of years for all of us. So as you guys know, we completed our PROS plan, our Parks, Open Space and Recreation plan this last April, and that was about a two-year process. Through that process, my understanding is that there was some requests from this board to review PIF credits and pocket parks. And my understanding is that those were reviewed. When I went to the Parks Advisory Board before I got here and we were reviewing those things, the pocket parks was not something that we moved forward in the PROS plan. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One of those is that we still have 17 undeveloped parks within the Greater Clark Park District that we need to develop. In addition, there's a balance, right? It's like all of our budgets between developing new parks and having the staff and funding to actually manage those. And we're at that point right now where with where our levy is and our funding is that we've developed 9-10 new parks since the last time we increased our staffing for operations. And so we're really trying to make sure we understand what our maintenance management plan is, so what our FTE requirements are before we add on. And in the PROS plan, we identified how we're looking at what is that new park's operational cost before we push the go button to develop it. And so the last thing I want to do is develop 20 new parks or 4 new parks that we don't have the capacity to meet our level standard. In an old life, I would call that gold plating a turd. You know, there's no reason by building something great that we can't really maintain. And so that's something we really want to be as a good steward of a county's resources. And so that is one thing where before we look at adding a smaller park and more of those is making sure we have the capacity. Because in that original levy, it said that we had to push the stop button when we weren't able to manage those parks. And nationally, looking at ours, we us versus comparable park districts, we have more acres than comparable sized, a lot more acres to manage and a lot fewer staff. And so again, we want to make sure that we're going through the policy process and making sure we've got those things in order before we start something new. I know PIF credits was another item that was reviewed, and PIF credits require some work for us in that we have to have good park standards set aside so that we can hand those to a developer and say, here's what our standards are, and then make sure that they get delivered in that way. And we don't have those CAD drawings, those standard books yet in a situation or a spot to be able to move that. And we're in a point where to do our current capital planning and stuff, we had, when I got hired here, one park planner and one development manager. We're continue to expand our planners to be able to meet our development needs and to be able to take on developing that standard book and those elements to then be able to go forth and review and take that time to look at the PIF credit process. That's a summary of the two things that I'm aware of that potentially you guys had questions on, and I'll open it up to you for any questions.
Thanks for coming, Rocky, and David, welcome. When we were originally talking about this, we were discussing this as a way to, and what it came from was, oh my gosh, the PIF credits went up by a whole lot because they hadn't been increased for a while. But when that was explained to us, it was explained to us because there was a deficit in the either acquired land for that or the developed parks themselves. And within the parks plan, you wanted to have a certain number of neighborhood parks within a certain radius, and then you expanded community parks and so on. And we're all sitting around the table going, well, wait a minute. The last four subdivisions I did, we put a park in there. You know why? Because people like parks. We also put a bunch of walking trails in there too. Why? Because people like to walk. And so we looked at that as a component or a piece of maybe solving a larger problem. Mm-hmm. And that was to reduce the deficit that's out there, to look at what we're already doing as far as reducing the overall deficit. That deficit directly impacted the park impact fees, as well as the cost of the county to purchase the property. Private development can purchase that property a lot cheaper and develop it a lot cheaper and still provide what? And maintain it a lot cheaper. And you're getting the same, so a bigger bang for your buck. Now, this is not a 5-acre park. This is a 1-acre park or a 2-acre park or a 10,000 square foot park, but a park nonetheless. And it's something that most of the developers that we work with want to include as an amenity into their projects because that attracts buyers. And so we're like, well, gosh, you know, why couldn't we do that? So that's where the conversation started was, is there a way that if there can be a park developed or trailway developed within a particular development, why wouldn't you be able to get PIF credits associated with that? Because that is in essence reducing that that overall deficit of parkland that is out there. Second point, we have really struggled with why schools are not included in that overall park number, the total acreage. They have everything that a park has. They have play areas, they have walking paths, they have benches, they have trash, they have this, that, and the other thing. For some reason, that hasn't been included in there. And that would go a long way. And here's the thing, is that people are using schools as parks. And so when you start taking a look at a deficit area, an area that doesn't have that, okay, so I live right next door to Eisenhower. Eisenhower's got a park. Are you going to discount that when you're, oh, and Jason Lee's right down the road. So are you going to look at that area and go, well, you guys don't have a park, so we need to somehow acquire more land in this area for a park?
Well, at Eisenhower specifically, we do have a park there, a neighborhood park, and the school, and they are touching, so we have. And my understanding is the current definition for our acreage count for that level of service for the different types of parks within the Greater Clark Park District are those that are owned and managed by the county. And I think you're bringing up a different alternative is other properties that are serving that need that aren't owned or managed by Clark County. And
mm-hmm.
We'll look into that and see what the RCWs and the codes allow us to do.
Please.
You know, and come back and tell you what we found. I've been in government a long time, and there's a lot of rules.
Sure. No, we get it. We get it.
More and more of them. So it takes time sometimes to figure out that specific answer. You know, is it 2 feet or 1 feet? You know, sometimes getting that answer is takes a while.
But very much like this board, we thought that would be a great public-private partnership in order to reduce that overall park deficit.
Yeah, that's an interesting point in regards to if a homeowners association or developers going to build it to a standard
mm-hmm.
and maintain it in the future. That does sound like a win-win situation.
Right. And understanding, so I was recently involved with a development out in Camas, and as part of that, we built a 5-acre park. I mean, big planned unit development. So that, and that's not necessarily what I'm talking about here, but as part of that negotiation with the city, they granted the developer park credits on future building permits for developing the park. And then they have to maintain the park. Now, the park is owned by the city of Camas now, but they have to maintain the park for 10 years. And then the maintenance gets turned over once that agreement has been met. So I think there are a number of different ways to go about doing this that would benefit everyone, especially from the park impact fee standpoint. You might see larger parks in some developments as a result of that. You might find those that aren't doing any parks start doing parks. And we're talking, you know, if you have a subdivision of, you know, 30 or 50 houses, you know, you don't need to have a 5-acre park. You know, something that provides some level of recreation for, you know, everybody that lives there, or even neighboring neighborhoods, goes a long ways. And in that way, the county doesn't have to then figure out how to acquire additional parkland within these newer community areas as we start to expand out from a land development or a residential development standpoint. So yeah, if you could look into that and let us know if that's even possible, because we never got any answers.
Okay.
Last time, I know that Eric Galima was part of that, but I know that the counselors were like, "Wow, yeah, that's a really good idea," and everybody said, "Yeah, that's a really good idea," and then crickets. Well, COVID is what it was. And then it's finally, you know, we're coming back to it. So yeah, if you could find that out and come back to us in the future and let us know if that's even possible, I think that would go a long ways.
Hey, Rocky, you might want to look at the Battleground city code. I did a park out in Battleground and, you know, it worked really well. I got a lot of PIP credits for it. And it, you know, I had to develop it, maintain it for a certain period of time until it was such and such. And then the city accepted stuff, and it worked really well. So you just might want to look at their code or talk to somebody out there.
And I think someone else brought up City Ridgefield as well, because I know they're doing those mini pocket parks in that area. And of course, it's growing like everywhere is around here. Which, trying to find a 3 to 5 acre parcel within the urban growth area from Oregon, so I always say growth boundary, so I apologize if I slip. It's hard because it's already bought. Or, you know, the price is $250,000 an acre or whatever the price is, so, or more. Although, you know.
And the reason this is important for the future
is
that those PIPs are only going to continue to increase probably at the same rate as they were last time.
Right.
Because the price of land is going to continue to go up. You're going to have to recalibrate those PIPs, and the land's going to be even scarcer.
That is true. You know, and I think we've been talking about City of Vancouver has an ability to buy community parks outside of their boundary by a certain distance. Again, so that was an idea that we've been talking about internally. Is there a code change to allow us to go a mile or a mile and a half outside of our PIF district? Because we know where it's going, and what appears to have occurred is we were ahead of the development in the past and were able to buy property before people start moving out there and building it. And so we're very grateful for having those plots of land now to develop as everyone's building around.
City just did that with a piece of property on the north side of 4th Plain, just east of 164th, as a matter of fact. Big piece of 15, 20, 30 acres, something like that. So, but they've got it. It's not going to be developed for a while, but they own it.
But having, you know, that strategic ability, and if we're able to use our acquisition dollars to build across that line when it's still zoned something different at a lower price, there's lots of 20-acre parcels within a mile, not a lot, but in comparison to inside that UGA that are potentially open, and the price isn't too scary in comparison. So, I think, Terry, you had a question?
Yeah. Staffing, I don't know, maybe long-range planning could help
Are you talking about development standards for parks?
Well, yeah, the health in regards to, there's things that, there's projects, you know, that I did recently, and we have six different open space to park areas within a 40-acre project of 300 lots, and we have a dog park, and we have a swing set with three different picnic tables and benches, and then we have a trail that goes almost basically vertically and horizontally to the project, and we have another swing set area, and then a large section of grass area, and we have two other grass areas. And those are all things that we did that we felt we wanted to do for the community, that it was desirable for that community, things that we couldn't do with parking spaces. So that makes it very available to that specific community, but it doesn't make it available to anyone maybe that wants to come and use that, those amenities. And not having that flexibility on something is really silly. The fact that you can't use any of that open space area. That's working with PUD designs and allowing for parking spaces. Obviously, you don't want to, you got to be careful with that it isn't misused with the intention is, but I do think being a value to some parking to allow for outside users to use those amenities would be nice. Some basic standards to be able to help. We tried to provide a trail connection from the Creek Trail system to the community, and we saw that as a value and some of those are needed in that area, and a continuation of what is really well that's existing, a very nice amenity for that west side area. And there is no process as we can discern in trying to involve everybody that people would go as far as how to get that trail designed, approved. We're talking about some stormwater implications. So if you have standard specs as to, hey, if you do a 4-foot windshield trail, this allows you to do it within buffer areas.
Right.
So I know that that's a heavy lift, and if someone who developed, I would love to be able to have that available. The park impact fee credits is something that should go along with it to make it something to promote to everybody, to benefit to everyone. But as an HOA, I would have had that HOA then do the maintenance of that trail, since it's not on the parks. But I couldn't even do that. I literally tried, and I was told no, like I couldn't. I'm not trying to blame anybody or whatever. There's been a lot of leadership transitions with COVID, and that's all understandable. Just to give you a little bit of background, though, this is just in the last 3 years. And in trying to do things the right way, to try and help them through, you're stuck. And it's frustrating. It's not our best foot forward. And I know the heavy lift, since there's nothing existing to be worked with.
Right.
So I don't, that's hard to work with.
Yeah, and to kind of maximize our bang for the buck for standards is that as we're doing new projects, we're trying to incorporate those elements that we're having for a brand new community park or neighborhood park being pulled aside and into sort of a standard book or folder of design to help with that. So we get the right size trash can, the right size, even right size color of the wood, is it treated raw or painted for a bench or
synthetic.
A picnic table. Or synthetic, yeah. It doesn't matter. People are going to scratch it, you know. But
I'll try to burn it down.
Well, yes, that is true. So we are trying to take those little things, and you're right. The shoreline and those other elements do create additional considerations and planning frustrations at times. Trying to make sure you're weaving elements. And I've tried to do projects in the city of Portland. I started one in 2014 at a state park just to improve the trail and bring it out of the wet spot up on the slope. It's still not done because there's a lot of process for that. So, but with that, I know we're doing the same issues and reviews on our projects, like out at Hawkinson Meadows with our new disc golf course. There's a trail going around it. Lots of wetlands out there, and trying to manage something that's going to be cost effective for us to maintain in the future and be that meet ADA requirements or at least minimums. So 4 foot doesn't meet ADA unless you have every 200 feet a pullout area, but then that's not allowed to get because it's more than 4 feet wide and chips. And so, see, there's all those things that then trigger additional mitigation and process. But again, it's trying to look at the long game versus that short game in regards to whereas looking at playground material. We did a cost analysis to determine wood chips are cheap up front, but if you're adding them every year, every 2 years like you're supposed to, and then every 10 years removing it all because now the compaction and what's the bounce test? I can't think of the name, but you know, it's not as bouncy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're replacing it. Actually, it costs more in a life cycle of 20 years for chips. And so again, it's trying to make sure we're showing the long-term value for even within our own park systems. So I feel your pain, and we're being new to Washington. I keep saying that until people won't let me say it anymore, is learning the nuances of those codes and RCWs versus just across the river. It's French versus Spanish. It's really darn close, but there's just enough change that luckily we do have community development planning, the consultants, all those that are able there to help us. And sometimes it takes a little bit of work to get it all together and understand the whys and where those little areas are to where we can meet that long-term need and still meet the mitigation requirements or shoreline permit requirements and those things.
When you get to the point of developing some development standards for the parks, I'm not sure if the parks plan, last time I reviewed it, there weren't any standards, design standards per se. There were goals, I guess, or something
points,
like that.
Yes.
Bullet points.
Yeah.
Once you get to that, as I've always said with any codes, steal shamelessly from what is already out there. Don't reinvent the wheel.
Right.
There are a lot of them. I know Camas has it. Probably Ridgefield has their own standards. Look at other jurisdictions and take the best of it. We'll look forward to reviewing those when you bring them to us.
We will be back.
At some point in time, I'm sure.
It'll take longer than we want, but we will continue to look into these things, and because we have a need to meet for the community, regardless who's meeting it. And it sounds like you're right. There are multiple partners out there that are assisting, and if we could get credit for it, that'd be great. I'd like to not have a D in some of the areas of the PIF districts for natural area open spaces, for example, maybe an F, but for all, we're doing pretty good in most areas, but it's still not A's everywhere. So that's the goal. Well, thanks. And
yeah, thank you, Rocky.
Stick around.
Thank you. The next item on the agenda is expiring terms of 5 members. And actually, I think when we looked at the list, there's a few more than that. Basically, end of March, Jamie, myself, Nick, Andrew, and Mike.
That's fine.
And then Sherry in July and Dan in December.
Oh,
so
did they take over? How did that work out? They're staggered years. They may have. You're only in year 2.
Yeah.
Did they take over terms for someone else that left? I don't think you did. You did, but then didn't you start your
I
normal
took over
term?
Nelson Holmberg's term, which I thought expires this July. So I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that for sure, but I think that's right.
It might be based off of people.
Oh, when we added.
Yeah.
That was when we added new person to Deeb.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
That is very
Well, I think what it does is the reason why we went to 3-year terms was so that we could stagger people, but I think the math would work out that at some point in time, they're all going to come back together, and then before they, I don't know, maybe not.
So I guess our concern was just that if we lose half the board, we wouldn't have quorum.
I will be reapplying to be on here.
Oh, right. Good.
Yeah. Is that you, Jeff?
This is
Yeah.
this is Jamie. I intend on reapplying. I didn't realize I was my turn in the cycle.
The March cycle is weird. I didn't realize we had a March, but that's...
Yeah, that's usually what it is. It's the July and the December cycle or whatever that was mentioned is the weird thing.
So I know, just as a point of clarification, I know last time we did this, I had to send in a letter of interest or something. Is that what the expectation is again?
I'm sure it is. Just change the date and print it out again.
Fair enough.
Who do we provide that to? I'm not one, but
county manager, I believe.
I know I provided it to Brent Davis last year.
Oh, we could send it. Yeah, we'll just send it to Megan, and Megan will pass it on.
Okay. Got it.
when our request to reapply.
Jeff and Jamie, did you catch that? You sent it to Megan.
You sent it to Megan. Okay.
Yeah,
and
I did.
And it's Jeff and I are the only ones that are up in March.
No, I am, and Seth, and
okay.
Andrew.
And Jeff is good through the end of 2024, so it's okay. Andrew.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, according to the list I have.
So I really want Seth to get re-upped because I don't want his... I want him to be able to continue to host the meetings.
Me too.
Oh, yeah. Your vice chair. So who was it again? Me, you, Andrew, Jamie, and...
And then Nick.
Oh, and Nick. Is Nick on today? Mr. Flair?
Yeah, no, he is. Yeah.
Oh, he is?
He was.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right.
That's weird. Yeah, he was.
Well, we'll need to... Megan, would you follow up with Nick on that and see if he's willing to... reapply to be on here, because if not, we'll need to find someone from the public sector, because that's his position.
And if Dan, you could forward that letter to Megan, then we can make sure those dates are updated too.
That one shows that I'm on there till 23, and my letter says through 24. So,
yeah. So we'll probably need to get those in this month.
Yeah.
And you will most likely have to post it also in the paper. Oh, okay. All right.
Please provide them by the end of next week to make
you get that, Jamie?
Yep, and I found my old letter.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Yes.
Okay, the next item is the mixed use code and standards. We have Mike Odrin and myself listed on here.
No. You can just cross me out.
I'll ask Dave Westman here. He's a planner with AKS to help talk through this. Were you guys able to get that PowerPoint? If you could pull that up, please.
All right, Dave Weston, AKS Engineering. I got asked to kind of explain some of the, I guess, challenges that came up when I was designing a mixed-use project in Clark County. And it was one of the first that actually made it through after the new standards came in during the recession there. So the first, one of the underlying issues appears to be townhomes. The design standards were written assuming all townhomes are multifamily. So they didn't really account for fee simple, which is extremely popular right now. It supplies that middle level housing that we're needing. And so the first one here is up on the screen. It's talking about the townhome. This is just the housing types. There's like eight of them in the design standards than the townhome one. One important thing to notice is at the bottom of the key applicable standards, it discusses being applicable to Chapter D, which would be fine if it was multifamily, but it becomes an issue when you're doing fee simple, and we'll touch on that further in the presentation. The biggest thing is staff is interpreting fee simple townhomes as single family, which I would agree, fee simple, single family, which is under Chapter G, but you can't have G and D. So that's the first thing. I think that either they need to have a new category for fee simple or townhome, the standards need to be modified to address fee simple in the single family detached section as well. So that's the first slide. Next slide, please. Yeah.
Before we go any further, So in section G, that's single family residential.
That's detached.
Detached. And so this is single family attached. Is it only single? And I'm leading somewhere with this. If it's single family attached, fee simple, it's single family. Can it be single family attached if it's not on fee simple lots? Right. Or
so
fourplexes or fiveplexes.
So
okay.
I tried
flex
3 units on one lot, which isn't
fee
simple by definition.
Okay.
Yeah.
There would that then be multifamily?
It would.
Okay.
Can you repeat that into the mic, please?
Yeah. So essentially, a duplex or a triplex, if it was on a single lot, would be multifamily. It wouldn't be, at least in my understanding, it wouldn't be considered fee simple or single lot residence.
Okay, thanks.
And there are design standards. One of the categories is duplexes. There's ADUs, there's cottage housing. There's no triplex or fourplex aside from multifamily. Okay. the next slide here is talking about the open space, and it's the requirement that we kind of had some issues with, and it came down to staff interpretation, was the 15% requirement should be applied to the net area of the development that is devoted to the single family uses. It's not clear in A1.5, and we were extremely lucky in this project. We had a great planner, and she used a lot of interpretation. Otherwise, the project, there's no way it would have been approved. So, any questions on that? Essentially, it's just saying that 15% of the development site. It doesn't say the portion, you know, that's related to the single family or anything.
So what you're saying is that in a mixed-use development, if you have a mix of uses,
right,
that they are interpreting that as 15% of the entire development and not just that area devoted to the single family and duplex uses.
So they could. I mean, it's not clear. So there is a multifamily requirement for open space.
Mm-hmm.
There's a single family, and then there's a commercial aspect. So if you just read this for what it is, it says 15% of the.
Can we overlap them?
That interpretation, right? So here we go.
All right.
Yeah.
Just thought I'd throw that out there.
And, you know, I like flexible code. It's not, I'm nothing against that. It's just, when you can't have consistency in the way it's interpreted, it does not work from a development standpoint. So, so my recommendation would be that the 15% is clearly stated as the net area that's devoted to the single family, fee simple townhomes, and duplex uses.
So essentially if you have all three components, single family, multifamily, and commercial, then you have three separate open space requirements?
Yes, and that is, I guess we only had two different in the project.
Two different uses, so you had two different open space requirements.
Two different open space requirements. We had multiple single family, but the townhomes were interpreted as single family detached. Therefore, we did 15% of the townhomes, the single family, the duplexes. And then we had our commercial requirements.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. The next section, A3.1, street corners. Just that it would be nice to have that exemption include fee simple townhomes. It makes sense when you're designing it. If it applies to the duplexes and the single family detached, it should also apply to those townhomes.
Sorry to keep chiming in, but is this because there isn't a definition of fee simple townhomes?
That would help.
Does that really come down to the basic question is having a definition of a differentiating between a multifamily townhome building and a fee simple townhome?
It would help, but the way the standards are written, it's still just townhome, detached, single family. So the standards still need to be addressed. But definition would be a great starting point.
Okay, because when I first looked at this, it all came down to the definition.
Yeah.
Okay.
C1.1, this is same kind of issue with fee simple townhomes. Essentially, you know, I had a neighborhood, we had detached product, and we had duplexes, and we had townhomes mixed into it, and there was no real direction. I guess based on this, you would be doing 8-foot sidewalks for the portion in front of your fee simple townhomes, and then transitioning to 5 feet when you go in front of your single family and your duplex, and vice versa. So I would recommend that, you know, the fee simple townhomes are included in that 5-foot sidewalk requirement. D1.3 building entries. So this is when we get into that chapter D that I discussed. Chapter D is when you read through all the standards, it's looking at mixed use buildings where you have street fronting, office, commercial, those kinds of things, or maybe apartment complexes. But it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to design single family detached duplexes to the standard. And likewise, the fee simple townhomes falls into that category as well. And I just think they should be added to that as well. Really, I believe chapter D should be excluded from fee simple townhomes, but 3.2. I feel like it's pretty excessive. The duplex and detached single family aren't subject to it, and I also once again feel like the detached or the attached fee simple shouldn't be as well. What we ended up with was some setback requirements, and I think we ended up doing, to meet the code or the standard, we ended up doing a pedestrian-oriented space right next to the townhome lot, which is not really ideal. And luckily, we were able to just do enhanced landscaping instead of enticing people to be hanging out in the side yards of the neighborhood. Once again, next to the commercial building or whatever, we had those designed, we had plazas and all that stuff. That's great, but it just doesn't work in the townhomes.
Hey,
yeah.
Dave, for the permitting process that you use, and this is referencing Austin Heritage, correct?
It's not.
It's not. Okay.
No.
The project. Okay. So, are you typically using a plan unit development process? Does that work with mixed use? Does it not work with mixed use? Do you use a PUD process, or what process is being followed?
I did not.
We did
straight mixed use.
Okay.
I could see potentially benefits to doing a PUD, depending.
Would that simplify?
It would, once again, staff interpretation, because now you have PUD requirements for open space of 12%.
Right.
And then I've got 15% on my single family. And then I've got, I don't know, it's based on square footage for my commercial. It gets really messy. So, and we looked at PUD, and that's why we scaled back. And we were like, we're going to try to make it as simple as we can to get this project approved, you know, in a way that is marketable.
So I'm, April, just to give you a little bit of background, is we have, my personal opinion take is we have quite a few different mixed-use parcels that I would say in general have been untouched. People have avoided them completely. There are a few examples that have, right, and that's what Dan specifically focuses on, that kind of product. And the fact that he hasn't touched it tells you something. In the case of Austin Heritage that did happen, Jamie can speak to that, what that developer's agreement process was to be able to navigate the mixed-use code. It provided, right, that flexibility in code interpretations and whatnot to help to navigate through it, and it still was extremely arduous. How long did that DA process take, Jamie? Was it 3 years? I don't know if he's there.
Yeah, so in that case...
Yeah, sorry, Terry.
Go ahead.
What was that last question? Sorry.
Oh, I was just saying, how long was the DA process for you at Austin Heritage and working to navigate the mixed-use code for that specific project? I just remember it being really long. Yeah.
It's very long, yes.
Yeah. And so the purpose of all this was to try and write, like... There's so much demand for lots, and this is providing, I would say, the highest demand out there of smaller product that's fee simple for people to get into that barrier of purchasing a home, but yet it's not being used. And I feel like historically there was some staff concerns in regards to interpretation of code, and that this was there was a lot of design standards that were implemented, but and that I'll say were idealistic, but didn't functionally work based off of how we're seeing it translate and the fact there has been such high demand and these parcels have just been untouched in general. I can think of three mixed use projects that have been developed in the last 10 years. Okay. You did two?
Just one.
So
I have,
and you're
done,
talking about two of the largest engineering civil firms in Clark County. Yeah.
That's based on the new code. The prior code before this, the mixed use was pretty common because the prior code was pretty simplistic.
Right.
And going through and that mixed use, you can probably run the numbers and see how much more was going than the new mixed use.
That's accurate, Houston. And I have done a lot of feasibility on mixed-use parcels in Clark County, and they just don't pencil at the end of the day. It, you know, it's between location. You know, a lot of them are in the larger parcels that are out in the urban boundary, which I understand that's where the big parcels are. It's just, you know, we're a long ways away from that developing that way. And then even the ones that are inside, a lot of them have access issues on state highways where you... How do you have commercial and you can't even have access to your development? I mean, that kind of stuff, it's just, you know, at the end of the day, it's just not worth it. So it's unfortunate because I think it could create a great, you know, community. Luckily, we have the PUD standards and we're able to create some pretty neat communities that way, but the mixed use would be better if we could actually make it work.
Thanks. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. Next one's real simple thing that came up, and it's in regards to fences, E2.1. Just, it gives you, so E2.1 gives you a staff can allow a taller wall to mitigate noise impacts. And we ran into what the definition of a long a public street is and how close we could have our trash enclosure. And in our case, we're surrounded on three of our sides by streets. So luckily, it was one of those things that kind of slipped through and no one brought it up. But I mean, by definition, we wouldn't have met the code because we needed a 6-foot tall screen of some kind. And unless we put it like in the center of our site, which doesn't really function from a, you know, solid waste perspective, that's what we would have been stuck with. So it's just, there should be some exceptions, and specifically for, at a minimum, a staff allowed, you know, interpretation like there is for this noise impact, but trash enclosures, I just think should be exempt from that as long as they're screened. So now we get into G. G is the single family detached code section. A lot of these, I think, are just going to be adding fee simple townhomes to it. So yeah, the first one's just that fee simple townhomes should be included in the description. That's the way staff has interpreted it. That's the way a hearing examiner has interpreted it for us. So, unless they're going to have their own section, then it just needs to be clear so everyone knows what they're getting into before they start spending money on property and design. G21C, the lot design. Okay, so this is where it gets kind of interesting. So 21C has a maximum 20-foot setback for garages. So, and a minimum off of the street would be 18 in the county. So our garage is 18 to 20 feet. That's the space we have to put it. And I don't know if I have the other section here. We do. So, okay. So at this point, I'll just state that there is a lot of great communities historically and some modern stuff where garages are pushed back further to de-emphasize, to bring the house up. A lot of times, like old neighborhoods, city of Vancouver, look all over, you know, the ones that weren't served by alleys, a lot of times those detached garages
back
pushed all the way towards the back property. Mm-hmm. Some of those, you know, could have ADUs or whatever. And it would just be great. But based on this code, 20 foot is the max. And that'll kind of tie in when we go to this next page too. So G2.2 is the floor area ratio. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this was a mistake and it was supposed to be a minimum FAR instead of a maximum. I'm kind of confused by it, but it seems contradictory to normal mixed use where we would be trying to spread out development rather than do a higher density. So like an example, if you do a 0.5 FAR on a townhome, say it's 2,000 square feet, 20 feet wide, just, you know, make simple math here. Like you got a really deep lot to make it work.
Square foot lot.
Yeah. 4,000 square foot lot, 200 square foot or 200 foot depth lot. Like it just doesn't make sense. So I don't know where that came from or how that got implemented, but so from a townhome standpoint, fee simple townhome, it's just not even practical. You can't develop them. From a single family standpoint, you're really limiting two story homes. And especially since the permit department is including garages in that FAR, as you would for like parking garages and stuff, where normally you have FARs, not single family homes. So we ran into it on that project where we ended up with some single family, less dense product essentially because of that maximum 0.5 FAR. So that's definitely something that needs to be looked into, because if staff follows code or these design standards, there won't be any fee simple townhomes built under the mixed use code anymore.
I mean, I would say out of everything, this is the one that makes it the most impossible.
This has wiped out an entire housing type, and it's one of the housing types that we really need in the county, so it's important. Uh, 2.5, this kind of leads back into our 20-foot maximum garage setback, which I just saw. This says 20-foot minimum on the little exhibit, which is interesting. But so it says that, you know, the setback for the garage shall be 18 feet from property line, which is standard code. And then we can have up to 20 based on the previous section. So our garage is 18 to 20 feet back. And then our front facade of the home has to be 5 feet in front of our garage. And so what you essentially have is, it's not as goofy on a single story, but you have a 5 foot, you know, front, and then you have your garage setback 10 feet. But when you do a second story and the front facade is the entire front facade, now you pull your second story out to 5 feet. And you just, and say like in townhomes especially, so you have these little holes 18 foot wide, or, well, I guess in this code it'd only be
12 feet wide, but you'd have these little holes that are 5 feet deep by 12 feet wide every garage on these buildings. And I think the intent is great, de-emphasize garages. And luckily, we were able to work with the planner, and we ended up with a short bump out, and then we had a bump out over the garage as well, but nowhere, it was like 2 feet, which structurally from building, and I'm sure Dan can speak to this, like the difference between 5 foot and 2 foot cantilever is, I mean, it's substantial. So, and it just looks weird. Like if you actually look at what it's asking you to do. Yeah. So and then in front of the 5 feet bump out of your front facade, you also have your required porch. So now you're another 6 feet out. We drew it up and like, you know, sketched it up, and the client was like, I'm not building that. You can't sell that. I mean, it looks horrible. So I don't think that's the intent. I think the intent is to de-emphasize a garage. I think there should be other options to de-emphasize a garage. Along with that, the requirement is for a maximum 50% garage facade for detached single family, which once again, remember now single family detached townhomes are included in Chapter G. So this applies to townhomes as well. So say a 24-foot product, we could have a 12-foot garage maximum. Okay, that's what we did. But then we have alleys loaded product, and it's not clear, and it's not clear in the codes if an alley is a street. It seems like it depends on if it's, it just depends on situation. Sometimes they're kind of treated like streets, but they're not. They're kind of treated like driveway. It's not defined. That's part of the problem. So the big thing here is that I do not believe, and staff agreed with us, and we got through the hearing, that if it was accessed off of an alley, so the garage is accessed off an alley, the 50% maximum facade didn't apply. And this is good for the county because, one, it's going to provide more parking because you just doubled your parking, and it's hidden, which is great. And the other side is it's going to promote people to use alleys because you get double the parking. So and you get more parking in front of the unit. So I think it just needs to be clear that, you know, it's talking about a street and not necessarily an alley. And it comes down to interpretation as of right now. And at some point, the hearing examiner is going to pull something out, and then it's going to become code, basically. So I would prefer that it was just clear in the design standards. 2.6. Okay, so this kind of goes back to the setback on the second stories and how the garage, the facade, the front facade is depicted. We've pretty much already discussed that, so I'll skip over 2.6 and 2.8. Which one? So in 2.8, we should, it's one in here, I think it even says it, no more than one driveway per dwelling unit. But then in the ADU section, let's see, driveways. Yeah, so the ADUs aren't allowed to have their own driveway. So, but I just say that if an ADU and the, you know, the single family home that it's on the same lot of, if they're on separate streets like a corner lot, they really should be allowed to have an individual driveway. The same way that if you do the duplex on two streets, this standards allow for you to have the two driveways. It would entice you to build more of the ADUs versus the duplexes potentially. And that's another niche of housing need that I believe the county is trying to promote. And then this goes back, they talk about driveways for individual lots 50 feet or wider may be up to 20 feet. So that means anything less than 50 has to be a 12-foot width. And this goes back to if it's accessed off the alley, I don't feel that the driveway width restriction should apply. Because once again, we're trying to get the parking and stuff out of the front of the units. And that has been how staff has applied
that code in regards to an alley not necessarily being a street. So. Okay, questions or other? So the apartments, I did a couple feasibilities for apartments inside mixed-use developments, and they have their own challenges, but I never ran them through a hearing or anything, and we never went through staff, so I'm not certain. I don't know if anyone else has. Mike, you have apartments on anything? So
Does anyone know of...
Not mixed-use.
Does anyone know of an apartment project that was done within mixed-use?
So I'm pretty certain the old Saddle Club has apartments, but I haven't seen their approved plans yet.
Okay.
The Fountains was done with the old mixed use.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anything with the new mixed use? The Saddle Club?
I could check the Saddle Club. When I did some feasibility work on that site, and there were apartments at that time. So I'm not certain that they followed through with it.
Yeah.
We have a project in right now.
Oh, you do?
Can we get you a mic? Sorry.
Oh, there is one. Right there by Lowe's.
I think there's a project in there right now that has the new mixed use.
Yeah, okay. The one south of Lowe's or whatever right there has apartments with some townhome and...
Oh, is that the old Mill Plain Elementary?
Right in front of the school, between 117th and the school.
Yeah.
Mm.
Does anyone know who the civil is on that?
Yeah,
I think we're doing that.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with it personally, okay. So I'll check in with Travis on that.
Yeah, that'd be good to know how that... Yeah. Is with.
Yeah, I just went through a hearing a month and a half ago or so.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It was one of the things that I originally had brought up with Seth, and then it was based off of hearing about Dave's experience, but also just being aware of mixed use zoning has been applied. The areas that I think about it are typically more so rural areas within the UGA.
Mm-hmm.
And so not, you know, City of Vancouver to me is when I think mixed use, I think of more so dense areas like downtown Vancouver, maybe when I second corridor. So it's this interesting conundrum to me of how do you navigate that? But it has indirectly become, I would say, kind of like land banked areas with this zoning that don't typically get touched. And it's unfortunate because it could really help with our supply issues that we have. So, and then specifically to those landowners, it's unfortunate as well. Like, I don't think they had any idea what the impacts would be to them long term.
I think some of those areas, and maybe somebody in long range like Jose can correct me or give me some ideas. When they are doing the comp plan updates, they have certain goals to be met, housing goals and employment goals and things like that. And mixed use checks off a lot of boxes.
It's the Swiss Army knife. And I would say initially in my time, and Jamie and Jeff could speak to this, if we go back to Commissioners Craig Pridemore and Judy Stanton, when most of this was provided, and what year would that? That would have been 2007.
That would have been 2004.
Six.
Oh yeah, it was long. Yeah.
2000.
So these parcels have all been there since 2004, to give context, as far as zoned, usable, untouched.
One other thing, if I can bring it up, while you have the Parks Department here, it might be a good segue. And I've done this, not necessarily in mixed use, but large plan unit development type product and master plans, especially on the east side of Washington. And if you look at your mixed use projects you have or your properties, they're usually large properties right now that are sitting with 15% open space. So you could tie a public park into those very well with some cooperation between, or coordination, maybe a better word, with the Parks Department and the developer. Because if you got a 40-acre site, you know, you minus your streets out and you're talking 15%, you're talking areas of 3, 4, 5, 6 acres of open space you can put in there. And what we've done with the different jurisdictions, I've tried to do this in Clark County, with prior Parks Department management. It just hasn't worked, even with large open spaces congregated to meet park spec. I've gone through the whole thing with the Parks Department and never got one, even with approved spec, to go. But typically with the jurisdictions on these larger developments, we'll do a large area, so 4 or 5 acres, and then tie the trails in. HOA manages the trails. We put public right-of-way access over everything on the trails, and then the park gets dedicated at completion to the Parks Department. But it would be a good way to integrate and really utilize that mixed-use code, if that's what you're trying to do, because you're going to get your higher density, your detached housing, and your commercial all. And if you had a public park in, you can tie it, because the best way to use a park is if it's centered in a development, especially if it's public. So I figured I'd just bring that and segue up real quick.
I think that's a great idea, because then you can also take advantage and get the biggest bang for the buck for your required open space areas, for each of the areas.
Yeah, it would work. And then there's it's always been kind of weird in Clark County. Everybody kind of, you know, shifts PIFs here and there, and they want to do this. Most of the jurisdictions in Eastern Washington, we just figure out how many units it is. So this park covers 100 units, covers 500 units, and then we just start wiping them off the plat. So there may only be, you know, 30 units that are applicable to parks, or that what we ideally try to do is just match it right up. So there's no exchanging of, you know, I got to give Dan $300,000 of PIF fees, and then he's got to figure out, well, I only can use 200. Now what am I going to do with the other 100? And it takes a lot of that monkey motion out, and then it's easier from the county's aspect too, because then they're not having to do an audit and the accounting work on it. And we just put those straight on the plat.
And one of the things too I've looked at in mixed use tracts is, like, you have commercial use on that other portion, and so that park's flexibility would be huge, just because unfortunately where the mixed use zoning is at, in the cases that I know of, it would work for light industrial, but it doesn't work for commercial, based off of location in a rural area. You just are not going to get a commercial use, unfortunately. And so in a lot of cases, then it just becomes just a vacant space, is the way you'd have to pencil it, make the project work. And it may be 7+ years down the road, maybe something comes of it, but it has to pencil with nothing happening with that. And so at least if there's parks, there's a benefit in those. And I could see that it's not gonna work for every site, but it could work for some.
Thank you, Dave.
Sorry to keep interjecting. And just, you know, to Terry's point with the commercial, there is, it may be wise to look at opening up some of the additional commercial aspects of the mixed use, because I've looked at, you know, mixed use projects, and you go through the commercial, like, oh, that'd make a good site for this. But then you go down through what's allowed for commercial in there, and it's like, oh, if it was just a commercial piece, if it was general commercial or C2 or C3, I could put this in here, but under mixed use, I can't. So then it goes to your point. It just ends up sitting till you get relatively developed out.
Like what?
I don't have any off the top of my head, but it's Dave probably does.
So I'll get to that question in a sec, but to Terry's point, when we're doing those feasibilities, the commercial land is almost of no value. I mean, the owner is giving that land away in order to sell his project. But back to the uses, one that I was surprised wasn't allowed, and it would have worked in our scenario, was private recreation. So whether it's Dizzy Castle or, I don't know, something non-food related, because if it had food or drink, I think it was allowed, but athletic clubs didn't count. It couldn't be anything private. Only public recreation was allowed in that mixed use. And that was too bad, because I think we could have made a destination work, just not drive-by traffic type commercial, which is really what it's focused towards.
Yeah. It has to be
Yeah. So in general, the kind of the theme I would say is it, there's these very design specific things just to mixed use. And all of our other zonings don't have that. And it hasn't been that we have things that have been regressive against Clark County and how homes appear and how they're designed and built. And so, that's the part I don't understand as far as why have those design standards in. If everything else doesn't have design standards, why couldn't we provide that same flexibility or just take out, remove that language and those problems go away? You still have the ability to, for flexibility, maybe on long range planning side and for meeting different things for our Growth Management Act, but if we can provide greater flexibility that just meets and matches our other zonings that are just typical, then it, problems are solved. It's not trying to like, I guess the problem is I feel like every time we talk about zoning stuff, it feels like we're trying to avoid or get a free pass on something. But this is, if we could actually just get to something similar to what we have for current zoning, it would, and current codes, that's not mixed use, then it solves all the problems.
So to your point, Terry, there's plenty of jurisdictions that promote mixed use through standard zoning. And that's essentially what Austin Heritage was through that DA, is they took the mixed use away and they zoned it with different uses to create mixed use. Battleground just got rid of their mixed use code because they saw it didn't work. Those parcels just sit. But, you know, if it's feasible in commercial, you can put residential above. You know, so maybe some of these parcels where commercial is not feasible today, but in 20 years it is, but you can start building up your base around it while the zone portion is commercial, it might not be a bad way to go.
I think that's funny that you say 20 years from now, because I remember talking when I first started in my career to a planner. And they said, I said, well, why is this zoned this way? Because it doesn't make any sense. And the planner said, and I don't remember what jurisdiction, he said, well, we don't zone for today. We zone for 20 years from now. Well, guess what? It's 20 years from now. It's 20 years from now.
I guess a lot of the items in this PowerPoint are specific to the mixed use design standards. And I guess, April, could you speak to what would be the process to update those design standards? Is it easier than updating code?
Well, a couple of things that I'm looking at. Remember, the last biannual was the first time we had done biannual. But I don't know. The answer is I don't know. I'd have to get with Oliver and his group. But also, one of my observations is there's a lot that you want to change here. And so I don't know how to, I don't know. There's a lot there though.
Could we tick a lot of those off with a definition change? No?
There's some, but the design standards, when you look at townhouse design standards, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff in here that just makes it to where you build a product that is less and less marketable, which means that you have more and more risk. You've got design standards in there for variances with architectural stuff that was like in the Highway 99 overlay code. We basically would look at stuff and we would just, it's Highway 99. We're not building townhouses in there,
right?
Because of the liability risk that we would take of some of these requirements. So I just, it's, you know, as you know, I worked with Jan Bazal on the narrow lot,
yeah, like I was
code a long, long time ago, yeah. and he basically said, we build, you know, our townhouse developments look nice when they're done, and this would force them to look ugly when they're done.
Yeah. I remember that.
So I don't know, but I'll look into it.
Is there a mixed use code that, I mean, I don't, that was my concern, April, is that I know that there's a lot of changes here, which is daunting. And so it almost, to me, feels like you need to, ideally, there's a different code that you could look to adopt, because it feels like it's almost, might be easier to start from scratch. It's kind of like a house that's just a disarray. It's easier to scrape it and then start anew than to try and fix what you have that's existing. And I'm speaking out of, I'm not staff, so, but I don't know if there's any suggestions on any mixed use codes that would be something that could be, that's worked, that's been an example that people have worked with.
Like a jurisdiction that has a more modern code?
Yeah, mixed use code? That fits as far as what, yeah.
It's also pretty unique with Clark County and them being in the UGA versus in a more dense city setting.
So April, do you want to just check with staff and get back to us next month? Cool.
What was on Austin Heritage, Dave, were you involved in that? Okay. Was there, I mean, because that makes sense. I mean, if you just broke it down to, hey, this percentage is this zoning and this percentage is this zoning, and you revert to what they would typically do with that process, well, that you kind of indirectly are getting rid of what the mixed use code is, and you're reverting to what existing codes are, but you're breaking up into these chunks like what Austin Heritage was done. And that's a prime example to show you, if you do that, it can happen as far as be used and provide the housing types and be divided. Otherwise, it sits there. So I wonder what
you're saying is to make it into a mixed density development.
Yeah.
That's what we did in Battleground. I mean, I took a PUD and I matched the density. The neighbor on one part of it was multifamily, the other was 10,000 square foot lots, the other was 6,000 square foot lots, and then there was a big, huge church. So, you know, we matched all that around in mixed density.
So it's almost like beveling of zoning within the project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's not a very good term to use around here.
Sorry.
Beveling? No, sorry. No.
Just to make sure I'm understanding this as we look into it, fundamentally, the issue sounds like there's maybe a few definitions that would help out with some of the discussions around multifamily versus townhome versus duplex. In the end, they kind of end up looking the same, but they get defined differently as you go through the process, and that makes things uncertain with the way the code's written now. Second issue is boils down to design standards only, what I'm hearing correct. The mixed use isn't a problem as it sits. But what I'm hearing is there's not a bunch of design standards in those independent codes if you split them, or in those independent zones if you split them out. Right. Be it commercial, multifamily, single family, you build whatever you want, largely speaking, design-wise. You get to mixed use, and all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of rules about what it has to look like. And that's fundamentally the issue. Is what most of what your presentation is focused on is those. Well, none of those issues, is that correct? Did I understand correctly?
The standards do not address fee simple townhomes. That in itself is a big issue because some of those requirements you cannot meet with that product.
Right.
So that's one part of it. The other is as far as the standards and as a whole, I essentially try to create a utopia, I guess. And they tell you how many trash cans and what your spacing. I mean, they took the design and the fun out of the community. It's very prescriptive.
Okay.
And you're looking at the past 30 years.
Right. Yeah. R12 zoning, wouldn't that really kind of, if you were to look at that as far as what would allow for fee simple townhouse type zoning, that could give kind of fit to what you're speaking to, it's not a townhouse zoning, but it's R12, and it is the product that it provides for.
Hey, this is Jeff. And Jamie, you might be able to throw in here too, but in places like Ridgefield and all that, I mean, there is a bit of a fundamental difference with Clark County being so large, and you've got some of these mixed use sites that are kind of in the middle of nowhere, but you know, like we were talking about earlier, 20 years from now, who knows? But talking about prescriptive, that's exactly the problem with this code forever is it's been prescriptive, and the other jurisdictions that seem to be successful do it by with development agreement, and it's kind of a negotiation so you don't lose the creativity. And Jamie, I don't know if you if I'm on point on this or not, so I don't know if you can chime in on that too, but the prescriptiveness of it is a huge issue. And I think it went back all the, I don't think it's changed much since 2004, except gotten worse. We've had business park and office campus, I think have had the same issues, although one of them was gone or they, anyway, my two cents. I don't know if Jamie's still on, but Ridgefield seemed is where I have been involved in some, and it's all done by development agreement. It's a give and take, but there, you know, every jurisdiction is different. So.
Yeah, that Jeff, I know for Jamie, if he's not on at the moment, that's exactly what he did for Austin Heritage, which and kind of right. Like what Dan was speaking to is it basically broke it up like in Battleground into these different chunks of zoning within the site that allowed them to work within that. And so that really resolved those issues.
And to me, that's kind of what it takes to work. I just don't know if Clark County has the wherewithal to be able to do that. I don't know if that's not really the right word, but anyway, it it probably didn't contribute much at all, but I just want, you know, we got to allow more flexibility on a number of levels, which I know that's what we're trying to get to. I guess I'm just agreeing with everyone.
Yeah, I think DAs could be a way to resolve it, but I think for staff and timing, like that would be daunting to be doing DAs for every. Ideally, that's not a pathway to go. But that's the only way it's been able to happen to date.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been an issue for a while. Tough one. All right, thank you.
All right, well, we'll look for an update then from April with regard to the process to update development standards. And then Andrew, if you could also bring any feedback from that project. With that, we'll move to public comments.
One last thing. I neglected during the member comments to thank Noelle Laverne and Ryan Wilson for their testimony at the public hearing on the shared outdoor recreation space. I think that we didn't just repeat ourselves. Ryan's testimony was really on point and really good, and I would have thought brought it home to the counselors. So thank you for being there and doing that. It was a long night for all of us. Hopefully not for naught. Hopefully if Noelle, if you're out there listening, thanks for you being there and your testimony also.
All right. Any members of the public that would like to comment?
I was showing one last thing, Mike, thanks for being a warrior out there as always.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right. Hearing no public comment, the next DEEB meeting is scheduled for March 2nd. And with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you all.